Chapter 3 The burglary, then, had a very unsettling effect on the Bagthorpes. One might have thought that, having recovered the stolen property intact against all likelihood of this, they would have thought themselves lucky. They did not, or at least not for very long. The Isham Gazette had evidently thought the story of the Bagthorpe burglary too good to keep to themselves, and had passed it on to a national news service. The result was that practically every national daily covered it the following day, in each case giving the job of writing it up to the humorist on their staff. When Mr. Bagthorpe said that the family was now the laughingstock of England, he was hardly exaggerating. To be robbed of one's most valued possessions is a traumatic experience, and one that would normally excite sympathy. But to have these same valued possessions dumped straight back at the bottom of one's garden with a dismissive note from the burglar is another thing again. All the Bagthorpes found themselves shunning contact with other people because they could not endure the kind of remarks that were constantly being made to them. Mrs. Fosdyke, of course, was unavoidable and had to be put up with. Mr. Bagthorpe, who was always trying to get rid of her, thought that now was the moment to sack her, but his wife would not hear of it. Fire her. She is the oil that makes the wheels of this household turn, she said, and her leaving would mean the end of Stella Bright. As if to rub salt in the wound, the Buried Bones people rang up to say how enchanted they were by all the publicity Zero had had, and asking if Mr. Bagthorpe had arranged it all. They said they wanted to make another commercial featuring Zero. This would be along the same lines as the first, they explained, except that this time we would show him sleeping by a pile of comics, and instead of saying, Zero can't even act, we should say, Zero can't even catch a burglar when he is right under his nose. Jack thought his father overreacted to this suggestion. I don't see why you should mind, he protested. If Zero and me don't mind, I don't see why you should, and after all, it's his career. The burglary had a particularly bad effect on Grandma. It seemed to the others that it was she who had engineered the whole thing, and so she received scant sympathy. "Next time you leave a note to an intruder," Mr. Bagthorpe told her, "suggest he kidnap you." She spent hours in her room, carefully putting the photographs of Thomas back in their frames and rearranging them. For 2 days she had all her meals sent up on a tray, and on the third she emerged, managing to look quite frail and sad. "I have decided," she announced, during the course of an unusually silent breakfast, "that I wish to gather my family about me." They glanced at her, but went on eating. "The events of the past few days," she continued in what was evidently a well-rehearsed speech, "have brought home to me the uncertainties of human existence. I have realized on what a slender thread our happiness depends." She paused. "I think we have all realized that, Mother," said Mr. Bagthorpe through a mouthful of toast. "And some of us, of course, have realized it for years." "The search for happiness is one of the chief sources of unhappiness," George Bernard Shaw offered Tess. She was favored by a cold stare from Mr. Bagthorpe, who could never, to save his life, come up with an apt quotation. "Anonymous from Grimsby reckons the whole of civilization hangs on a thread," William said. "He reckons there's an alien intelligence out there, and its signals are getting stronger." This contribution to the general angst cut no ice with the rest of the family. "We don't much care what an anonymous radio ham from Grimsby says," Tess told him, "even if we believed in his existence, which some of us don't." "Nobody is listening to me at all," complained Grandma, with justification. "I am trying to say something important." "You were trying to say you wanted to gather your family about you," Mrs. Bagthorpe said helpfully. "We are your family, Mother, and we are around you." "I feel the need to gather my whole family about me," Grandma said. "I wish to see my children and my children's children gathered together, so that I can feel my life has not been in vain. I want a family reunion." This speech produced quite a long silence. "What she is really saying," Mr. Bagthorpe told the rest of the table at length, "is that she wants Claude and his sainted tribe, though why I am at a loss to imagine." "If you want to see Claude, Mother, you go and see him. Leave the rest of us out of it." Grandma turned a piteous gaze on him. "I don't think you understand, Henry," she said. "I want my whole brood about me, and I am an old lady," she added with uncharacteristic honesty, "and I think my wishes ought to be respected."
She always says,
"If she wants something, yes." Mrs. Bagthorpe looked worried at this. "Are you sure you have really thought about this?" she asked, "and all it would entail?" "Of course she hasn't," snapped Mr. Bagthorpe. "She would be driven out of her mind by that bunch of Latter-day Saints before any of us. She's probably forgotten that Penelope never stops quoting the Scriptures." "A familiarity with the Scriptures is not a vice, Henry," said Grandma piously. "Possibly," he returned, "but the non-stop evoking of them is." He was, of course, exaggerating, but the rest of the family was by and large with him on this score. Uncle Claude himself was inoffensive enough. If he irritated anyone, it was Grandma herself, because she liked people to show some fight. There was nothing Grandma enjoyed more than an all-out row, and Claude was hopeless in this respect. He was very mild and absent-minded and took after Grandpa. He was a parson, although, as Mr. Bagthorpe was fond of saying, what?
A parson.
A parson, yes. Although, as Mr. Bagthorpe was fond of saying, one would have thought it was Aunt Penelope who had taken holy orders. "She certainly acts as if she were under holy orders," he said, "and so, as far as I am concerned, anyone who thinks that Sherry... I'm sorry. And, so far as I am concerned, anyone who thinks that Sherry is something you use to flavor a trifle with is a stranger in my house." On previous visits from the dog-collar brigade, as he called them, Mr. Bagthorpe had been driven to taking his whiskies at the Fiddler's Arms. He preferred, he said, to knock them back under the gimlet eyes of Mrs. Fosdyke and company than to endure Aunt Penelope's condemnatory stare. "And when she's around," he stated, "I need to drink." The young Bagthorpes were not much more enthusiastic about the proposed reunion. Their dog-collar cousins, Esther, aged 7, and Luke, aged 11, were prim and unsmiling and, what was worse, extremely clever. They did not call their accomplishments strings to bows and boast shamelessly about them. They were merely infuriatingly clever, and managed to let people know this somehow without actually seeming to try. Esther, moreover, told tales. "I don't think I ask very much of life," Grandma now went on. "I try not to trouble people."
"Oh, yeah, right."
"It would, of course, entail a lot of extra work," said Mrs. Bagthorpe. At this point Mrs. Fosdyke chipped in. "Oh, don't mind me, Mrs. Bagthorpe," she said. "Not the least trouble, the reverend gentleman and his lady. And as for their children, helpfulness itself, such lovely manners." For this unsolicited testimonial she was rewarded by murderous glares from the younger Bagthorpes, and from Mr. Bagthorpe himself. The latter did not mind the implied criticism of his own offspring, though he had not particularly cared for the way she had emphasized the word gentleman. What he could not stand was Mrs. Fosdyke's continually butting in on conversations. This was one of the worst side effects of having a burned-out dining room, the result of a true-to-form Bagthorpian holocaust at their Christmas party, and having to eat every meal in the kitchen. Mrs. Fosdyke was either listening, banging and rattling pots, or else putting her spoke in. "There you are," cried Grandma triumphantly. "How very kind of you, Mrs. Fosdyke. You see, Laura, it is no trouble at all." Grandma's grasp of psychology must have been slipping, or she would not have made the mistake of enlisting Mrs. Fosdyke as an ally. Nothing could have been better calculated to drive Mr. Bagthorpe's heels more firmly in. "I think it is nervous wear and tear Laura was alluding to, Mother," he said coldly, "not mere domestic chores. Those of us who are of a sensitive disposition and engaged in wrestling with serious creative work are easily thrown off balance by disruptive elements. I personally do not believe I could finish my current script while being constantly bombarded by scriptures and texts. I think I would lose my sanity." "Oh, dear!" Mrs. Bagthorpe seemed easily to be able to deal with other people's problems in the persona of Stella Bright, but was invariably thrown by the problems that cropped up all too often on her own domestic front. Whenever Mr. Bagthorpe pointed this out, she would reply that it was all a matter of perspective, and that in order to view a problem clearly it was necessary to stand back from it. Once Mr. Bagthorpe had written to Stella Bright on a borrowed typewriter, and in his letter had outlined the precise problem that was currently confronting the Bagthorpe household. To his delight, Stella Bright had replied, confirming exactly his own viewpoint in the matter. He had triumphantly waved his reply under Mrs. Bagthorpe's nose, and had naturally got his own way. For months after this, whenever he and his wife had a difference of opinion, he would jibe, "What price Stella Bright?" and invariably get his own way again.